Well, a slightly belated Labor Day greeting to all of you who labor. And I am eternally grateful for all those noble professions and all those doers that populate them. This is Nick D, your host, and this is the space that we call the Far Biddle. It's a happy place. And I believe we've got a really fun topic to discuss today. So let's hop right into it, jump right into it with our sports dedication. And this week we dedicate the episode to the captain, as in Captain Red Wing, as in Stevie Y. Yeah, I'm talking about Steve Yzerman, hockey royalty and the epitome of a leader. He captained the Red Wings for an incredible 19 seasons. It's from 1986 until his retirement in 2006. That makes him the longest serving captain in that team's storied history. And again, we're talking about the Red Wings, so that's saying something. And he led those Red Wings to 3 Stanley Cup victories. He was the youngest captain to win a Stanley Cup in NHL history. And he scored damn near 700 goals in his career. Where's that rank him? That puts him among the all-time leading goal scorers and point leaders in NHL history. I believe he's 10th on the all-time goals list, a couple of goals, 2 goals ahead of Mario Lemieux. And Yzerman also won gold medals twice in the 2002 and 2010 Winter Olympics. Now, he wasn't only an offensive powerhouse, but he also excelled in his defensive responsibilities, a great two-way player, and he also had this uncanny ability to come up big in the clutch. He got that goal just when you needed it. And his ability to contribute at both ends of the ice in that clutch play set him apart from many other players, perhaps all the other peers at the time when he played, and it solidified his reputation as, again, that all-around great complete player. And that approach was something that got noticed and became idolized, frankly, and became the prototype for a future great who watched him as a kid when Yzerman was in his prime. And that kid's name grew up to be known as the hockey player that we know as Sidney Crosby. And Yzerman progressed to a successful career in the front office within the NHL after his playing days. He did that both in Detroit and Tampa Bay. And also, he's one of the great sportsmen, gentlemen of the game, always exuded great sportsmanship on the ice. He started and ended his long playing career with one team, of course, Detroit, the Red Wings. And these days, that's becoming a true rarity in professional sports. And by the way, it's another aspect that was mimicked by Sidney Crosby with his long career today playing out with one team, the Penguins. So let's all get out our hockey sticks. Ready? Sticks up in the air, sticks tapping on the ice as we salute one of the NHL's all-time greats. And alongside with Gordie Howe, the greatest Red Wing ever, Steve Yzerman. Well, that was a nice dedication. And this week on the Far Middle, we discuss a topic that I've been meaning to cover for well over 2 years, if you can believe that. And it's something that most of us don't give much thought to at first blush, that we pass right by and we can miss in our own town and also when traveling. But it's a topic that once you suddenly realize and you ponder for a few seconds, it instantly becomes of interest to us one way or another. And it leads to a whole bunch of fun. Now, I'm talking about history sitting right before your very eyes, and it's often hiding in plain sight, both in your hometown and, again, where your travels might take you, in the manifestation of all things hotels. That's right. Think about it. Most travelers spend time and invest money into exploring the history of a place, a town or city that they end up visiting. But that history and legacy, it's going to be in the context typically of things like museums, and monuments, and streets, and neighborhoods, and the like. And travelers, they give little to no thought to the hotel that they're staying at or that they walk by while exploring all that history. Yet the hotel itself often will offer up its own trove of rich history. You're living in the middle of it, literally during your trip for a few days or however long, but you give it zero thought. And that's a huge missed opportunity for those lovers of travel and history and sense of place. And of course, the older the hotel is an institution, the deeper the history and the more engaging the story. But you'd be surprised at how many locations offer up scores of hotels that carry fascinating stories within their walls. Heck, many towns and cities have more than one such hotel or location to offer. Certainly, every large American city can boast such a list. And in Europe, it's ridiculous how deep the history of hotels run. Now, I could prove my point by choosing from dozens of examples for places that I've stayed or sort of traveled through and walked through, and most travelers could do the same if they only realized where they were staying or walking past. So allow me to entertain you this week on the Far Middle by walking you through the awe-inspiring history of a hotel I recently had the pleasure of visiting in the Netherlands. And that makes a connection to our Steve Yzerman sports dedication because Stevie Y, he is of Dutch descent. Now, we will look to the city of The Hague, to be exact, which is the official seat of government of the Netherlands, although Amsterdam is the official capital. I know that's more complicated than it needs to be, but, you know, that's European bureaucracy for you. But anyway, there is a hotel in The Hague that deserves as much as any of its peers, singling out for use as our exemplar on how hotels offer as much history in them as the city's travelers explore while staying in the hotel. The name of the hotel is Hotel de Indes, and that's two words, de Indes, D-E-S, and then I-N-D-E-S. And what a story it has to tell that I'm going to share with you. And again, the point of this discussion is not just this hotel's story, but more importantly, don't miss on your next visit or trip to wherever life takes you, some history and culture that you can enjoy the benefit of, and you might be living right in the middle of for a few days. That could be an epic missed opportunity that you end up sleeping within during your stay. So here it goes. Let's take a closer look at Hotel de Indes, found in the center of The Hague. Let's start by talking about the location where the hotel resides in The Hague. As I said, it's in the city center, and it sits on the corner of the city's most famous tree-lined avenue, Lange Voorhout. Now, this tree-lined green space was originally envisioned and created back in the 1530s. And that's when the Holy Roman Emperor and House of Habsburg leader, Karl V, he visited The Hague, and he thought that a way to alleviate the city's overcrowding at the time was to take the front yards of several residences and use the space to make a prestigious walking avenue that was lined by trees. And for five centuries, that vision has provided one of Europe's most enjoyable urban venues. It's an awesome space. And they say in real estate, it's all about location, location, location. And with the Hotel de Indes, it enjoyed a prime location on the corner of what became the gathering sort of centerpiece of The Hague. Now, by the late 1500s, you saw the Middle Ages coming to an end, and the region that we know today as the Netherlands became a republic. It was 1588 to be exact. And its political center became The Hague. And this kicked off what became the Golden Age for the Dutch Empire, which became one of the most powerful empires in history. So the space was created that initiated the potential for an iconic location for the hotel. And then the Netherlands was formed and became the geopolitical powerhouse of its time, with its center of government located in The Hague. Again, I'm no expert in hospitality, but I would think it would be quickly obvious that the corner lot that the Hotel de Indes came to occupy quickly became prime real estate and ideal for a hotel. It was destined to happen, and indeed it did. But you know, it didn't happen right away. In fact, not much happened when it came to the establishment of a hotel location there for about 300 more years. But then events started to unfold. Things got really interesting in the mid-1800s. So first, a baron, no less, he enters the picture. His name was Baron van Breenen, and he was a counselor to King William III, and he wanted to have a town palace built in 1858 on that posh Lange Voorhout Avenue, that tree-lined space that I spoke about. And he chose this location, of course, because it was prime, but he already had an estate, but he wanted another one with stately accommodations in downtown The Hague so that he could be able to throw more parties. Now, this is European royalty we're talking about after all. So the baron started to build, and he built an urban palace. And there was a magnificent ballroom, and that served the subsequent hotel quite well. There were some other cool details to the estate that last to this day in the hotel. I'll give you one that I found intriguing in particular. So the baron had his initial B inscribed on all the doorknobs of each chamber. And these doorknobs, at least some of them, can still be admired to the present day on the doors of the hotel salon. And there's an interesting detail. There's a little hole in the top of the doorknob, and it's designed to accommodate a white or a red feather. So a white feather on the doorknob signified that entry was allowed, but if there was a red feather stuck in the doorknob, that meant that the baron really didn't want to be disturbed. Yeah, so try that at home and see if anyone listens. Good luck if your house is anything like mine. But despite his stature and his title and his fortune, the baron, he ultimately did what we all end up doing. He died. And a few years after the baron passed away, the palace building was sold. And after a renovation that lasted 4 years by the family of the buyer, it was finally dedicated as a hotel. The 1880 announcement heralded this first grade hotel as the largest in the residency and has been newly furnished according to the standards of this current time. And the Hotel de Indes was quite the item when it opened. And that also brings us, by the way, to the topic of the name of the hotel, de Indes. That name was inspired by a then famous hotel of the same name in Batavia, where what we know today is Indonesia, which happened to be a Dutch colony back then. And the coat of arms of Batavia is still displayed in the triangular decoration on the facade of the hotel and on the canopy over the hotel entrance. Now, the idea in mimicking the name of the famous Batavian hotel was to attract travelers from the Dutch East Indies to stay there when visiting The Hague. It's basically named exclusively for the sake of marketing. And the first guest, at least for dinner, was a famous Dutch artist, Hendrik Willem Mesdag, and the painter reserved a large table at the end of April in 1881 to celebrate a wedding anniversary with his wife and his closest friends. And Mesdag played a key role in the rise of a particular school of Dutch painting, the Hague School, and you art lovers might know what I speak of. Now, on May 1st, 1881, that's when the hotel was officially opened with a toast by Prince Frederick of Orange. And then 2 days later, the hotel hosted a famous ball, the Calicot Ball, or as we call it, calico in English. Now, calico is unbleached cotton, and the ball carries its name. It had attendees show up in costumes, dressed as Greeks and Turks, and in Renaissance style. The costume ball went on all night until 4 a.m., and it was a raging success, and there may have been more than a few headaches the next morning. Hotel de Indes soon made its mark as a really technologically progressive and innovative hotel. Each floor had a bathroom, and then a few years later, each room was outfitted with a bathroom. That was a new luxury, offering both hot and cold running water. And there was even an intercom system that guests could use to call reception from their rooms. Again, these things represented a type of luxury and technology that were unprecedented at that time. Then Tsar Nicholas II, the last emperor of Russia, the father of Anastasia, the eventual victim of a Bolshevik firing squad, the Tsar, he enters and plays a pivotal role in the hotel's legacy. So Tsar Nicholas II proposed to host a peace conference in The Hague in 1899. So you see a new gaggle of guests who consisted of leaders of state, and governors, and diplomats, they all found their way to the residential hotel. They stayed there for months as what came to be known as the first international peace conference unfolded. And one of them was, by the way, Paul Kruger, president of the Republic of South Africa and leader of the peasant rebellion known as the Boer War, and who the famous gold coin Krugerrand is named after for you coin collectors. And the Tsar's conference allowed the hotel to play a crucial role for the temporary residents of these attendees, and that cemented the hotel's reputation among the elites of the diplomatic service, which for The Hague, as the seat of Dutch government, that was a key constituency. American leadership was drawn to the Hotel de Indes. U.S. Presidents Benjamin Harrison and Teddy Roosevelt stayed at the hotel on separate occasions. Jimmy Carter made it there as well. And in this historic hotel, The Hague also has a very interesting Pittsburgh connection for you Western Pennsylvanians like myself. After the first peace conference in 1899, it was agreed that the world needed an international court of arbitration so that humans could avoid war. Now, does any of that sound familiar? Yeah, I guess we're still working on that thought or idea. Anyway, a donation was made by Andrew Carnegie, who at the time was the richest man in the world, to construct what became known as the Peace Palace in The Hague. And today it houses the International Court of Arbitration, it came to be. And before Andrew Carnegie's visit to The Hague in 1913 for the opening of the Peace Palace, the hotel hosted an army of security staff whose job was to protect Carnegie from kidnapping. Archduke Franz Ferdinand, I'm not talking about the musical group, I'm talking about the Archduke, the real deal, of Austria. He stayed at the hotel 3 years before his assassination, and of course his assassination triggered the start of World War I. Now, World War I created economic calamity in the Netherlands, which as a country, it remained neutral in the war, and it took an intervention by the Dutch government in 1918 to warrant the survival of Hotel de Indes. It basically needed a bailout. And the government purchased the hotel so that the Netherlands could offer war negotiators first-class lodging while they were involved in peace talks at the nearby Peace Palace. So think about it. The guy who's assassinated and his assassination led to World War I, he stays at the hotel a few years prior. The war took the hotel under financially, needed a bailout. And then the government intervened so the hotel could be offered to negotiators trying to end the war, who met in a peace palace funded by a Pittsburgh industry titan whose security team stayed at the hotel. Now, there's a series of connections for you that may be a far middle record. And the hotel bedded elites who met at The Hague for the Conference on Reparations in 1929, just before, by the way, the collapse in global financial markets. The Treaty of Versailles, those punitive German reparation payments, and that financial chaos in 1929, they were contributing causes of the rise of Hitler in World War II. And then came World War II, speaking of. And the Netherlands tried to remain neutral at the start of the war, hoping to copy its successful strategy for avoiding World War I. But unfortunately, Germany didn't see Netherlands' neutrality as acceptable. Hitler demanded the surrender of the Netherlands and was rebutted initially. So he proceeded to have Rotterdam destroyed by German bombers, and then he promised to unleash the same devastation on The Hague, Amsterdam, and other Dutch cities in the coming days if the Netherlands did not unconditionally surrender. So General Winckelmann, who was left in charge of the Dutch government after the Queen fled to London, he was facing certain further destruction across his country, and the general surrendered on May 14, 1940, a few doors down from the hotel. The German army took over the hotel after they occupied The Hague. There was a machine gun placed in the hallway, and a bust of Hitler was brought to the hotel to be placed at the reception area. Now, the hotel director, he decides to brazenly reject the bust, and surprise, surprise, the rejection was accepted by the Germans. How about that? Took some guts. And the hotel during World War II occupation became known as the Wehrmacht Hotel because so many German army officers resided there or used it as basically a functional headquarters. And after liberation by the Allies in World War II, American troops stayed at the hotel. And then Winston Churchill and General Montgomery were some of the first guests of the hotel after liberation. There's a photo that I saw there at the hotel of General Eisenhower, who was touring The Hague after the war with the hotel in the background of the photo. And by the way, Ike returned to the hotel in the early 1950s when he became the first NATO commander. And Andrew Carnegie wasn't the only American business titan to be connected to the hotel day in days. Henry Ford and his family stayed at the hotel in 1930 as he worked on building a Dutch manufacturing facility. William Hearst, the media tycoon, he stayed at the hotel regularly in the 1930s as he attended art shows looking for Dutch masters' pieces for his extensive art collection. Charles Lindbergh was at the hotel in the 1930s. And remember, he was, after his famous transatlantic flight, the biggest celebrity on the planet. And the Dalai Lama was there years later. Movie stars stayed at the hotel through the years. I thought this was pretty interesting, including Yvette Guilbert in 1902. Who's Yvette Guilbert? Well, Yvette was one of the world's first movie stars. She was a French cabaret singer and a writer, and the first cinema opened in Paris, so it makes sense that one of the first movie stars would be French. And the first black woman to star in a movie, Josephine Baker, she stayed at the hotel in 1955. Audrey Hepburn, love her, signed the hotel guest book during the mid-1980s, and Omar Sharif played in a bridge tournament at the hotel. So it's pretty steep with your sort of Hollywood celebrities. Rachmaninoff, one of the greatest composers of classical music, he slept at the hotel in 1928. And in the 1920s, you got to remember, ballerinas, they were almost rock stars when you looked across Europe. And the most famous ballerina in the world at the time was Anna Pavlova of the Dying Swan fame. She met her premature and unfortunate demise at the hotel in 1931 in the hotel's Japanese salon when she was traveling and staying at the hotel. She became ill and was told that she had pneumonia and required an operation. And she was also told that she would never be able to dance again if she went ahead with the operation. She refused to have the surgery, saying, "If I can't dance, then I'd rather be dead." She died shortly after. Perhaps ghosts roam those halls. Who knows? Prince, or the artist formerly known as Prince, he stayed at the hotel when he played Rotterdam, So did Michael Jackson and Bono through the years. And the arrival of Mick Jagger of the Rolling Stones at the hotel caused a mob of hysterical fans in front of the entryway. Now, the list of who's keeps stretching on and on, but you get the feel of the list and the extensive history that this hotel holds when it comes to celebrity. I hope this provided you an entertaining feel for the depth of history found within the walls of the Hotel de Indes. And to visit the hotel and where all this history occurred to see it doesn't require that you stay there. You can walk right in and look around, grab a drink, something to eat. The point is that there are hundreds of Hotel de Indes across America and Europe, just waiting to be appreciated and decoded with respect to their history. As I said, they're hiding in plain view. They're entirely missed if one is not aware of it. That's ironic because it's often with or by the person who's in pursuit of the very same history that played out down the street or around the block. And you will inevitably find something of specific interest to you, no matter what your walk of life or personal likes might be. So this realization changed the way I look around places when traveling, whether they're first-time visits or even repeat arrivals. Each time I head out to the road, whether for business or pleasure, I make it a point to do a little research prior to see where the oldest and most historic hotels sit in the city or the town or the area. And if I can swing it with schedule, I try to stop by, even if it's for only 15 minutes, to take in what I can. You'd be surprised at what you find. That's all I'll say. And this episode, sort of a byproduct of such an approach, stumbling upon the history of the Hotel de Indes by accident, but sort of by design. This accident by design approach, it'll likely lead you to discover anything and everything in the arena of design and architecture and history, celebrity, to all other kinds of surprises. It's fun and a bit habit forming as part of your travel routine. Give it a try. Let me know what you stumble across. I'd love to hear from you. Okay, how about one final connection to wrap this episode up into a nice Dutch package? What do you think? I got an amazing story with a direct connection to the Hotel de Indes and its history. And the story belongs to a man by the name of Kurt Irrgang. That's I-R-R-G-A-N-G. Kurt worked at the hotel for nearly 40 years, but it was his journey over those 40 years that is truly amazing. You have to hear this because it's hard to believe. Kurt was born in Germany in 1914. He moves to Belgium when he was a teenager to train in hospitality. Now, after he graduates from hotel school in Brussels, he moves to The Hague in the Netherlands, and he started a job as a lobby boy at the Hotel de Indes. Kurt marries a Dutch woman, and they have twins a few weeks prior to Germany invading the Netherlands. That's a tough time to raise newborns. But it got worse for dear Kurt. You see, the Germans, as I said, they set up their Wehrmacht headquarters at the hotel, so the army was basically in the hotel. And they find out quickly that Kurt, he's German-born. So they immediately assign him to join the German military. He's separated from his family, and he's dispatched to the worst front imaginable, the Russian front. That's the last place you'd want to be as a German foot soldier during World War II. And toward the end of the war, as Germany is collapsing, Kurt gets captured by the Russians in Czechoslovakia. He gets sent to a prison camp in Siberia, and he likely underwent and was subjected to forced labor, torture, and other trauma. He was really never able to speak of it to others upon his return. But he is finally released by the Russians a few years after the war's end, and he makes his way back to his family in The Hague. Kurt returns to the hotel to work. He climbs the ladder. He climbs his way up to become the head maitre d' of the hotel, and he finally becomes a Dutch citizen in 1956. And he becomes an iconic part of the hotel in the eyes of guests and staff. So hats off to Kurt. So it's time to close. And until next week, constant listeners, you stay connected to that far middle.